May it please the court, my name is Richard Hostetler, and I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellant, Mr. Gillespie, who, as the court knows, was convicted of felony first-degree murder and aggravated robbery as the predicate offense of that robbery. And that is the focus. Those two convictions are really the heart of this appeal, because I think the primary issue, the issue I wanted to talk about the most today, has to do with the felony murder statute and the robbery. We did raise some issues with respect to expert witnesses. I don't really intend to touch on that unless there are questions by the court, because, again, my focus, I think when I wrote this brief, was those convictions. And what we're arguing is that there was an insufficient evidence to convict Mr. Gillespie of the robbery. And a particular note is the fact that the robbery count in this case was directed at the owner. In other words, it was a robbery of the owner, not a robbery of the customer. And I think that's a critical point. Now, there are some issues that were raised by the prosecution of the government in the reply brief that I kind of designate as threshold issues. They're basically saying we don't even need to get to Mr. Hostetler's substantive merits arguments, because we can, one, substitute the attempted robbery of the owner as opposed to the actual robbery of the owner as the predicate offense for felony murder. And in my view, and I think it is correct, that in essence requires this court to direct a verdict on the lesser included offense that was not provided to the jury at trial. The government or the prosecution in this case elected to go simply on the aggravated robbery of the owner. They did not charge attempted aggravated robbery of the owner, and they did not request a lesser included offense instruction on the owner. And I think that they are tied to their trial strategy and have basically waived the argument that this court could theoretically use the lesser included offense of attempted robbery. So that's my first rebuttal. Secondly, I think that it kind of amazed me when I actually sat down and started looking at this case, and I started to say, okay, what is the authority of an appellate court to order the, or at least direct the verdict on a lesser included count, whether it's related to robbery, whether it's related to felony murder or otherwise? And as I read through the cases and the statutes, I find that there isn't really any clear explicit authority for the courts to do that, whether it's a trial court or whether it's an appellate court. And I address that in my brief through one of the cases. I can't remember right now the name of the case, but I use that as an example of when the Colorado Supreme Court said in a case did exactly what the prosecution is asking you to do. They cited some court rules, and I went back to those court rules, and the court rules really don't seem to give the court that authority. And it seems to me that if there's no authority for the court to do that, then again, the prosecution's remedy here that they're asking for, which is to basically to clean up the trial strategy by substituting our judgment or your judgment for the judgment of the jury. And even if you find that there is some authority somewhere in the court rules or statutes or whatever, it is an issue of first impression, at least as I see it, as to whether or not that authority is limited. And courts in other jurisdictions where they have allowed or found that they had authority to direct a verdict on the lesser included offense at the appellate level, they have done so only in cases where that option was provided to the jury in the jury instructions in the trial court. Only when it was provided to them as a option.
Mr. Austin, let me interrupt you here. I think we do understand that argument. I want to focus on the principal merits issue if I can.
Okay.
And I'll just tell you straight up, I'm having a little bit of trouble with your argument on Bartoszewski. You make a very compelling argument that maybe it was wrong and it changes the common law. I'm not sure where the right place to be making that argument. Perhaps that needs to be made upstairs. But so I'd like you to address for me, maybe I just don't understand it. But obviously we can't, we're bound by Bartoszewski. We have to apply that. So could you tell me, you know, how we don't, why aren't the elements satisfied under the rule of Bartoszewski, assuming that it applies? And if you want to, obviously, if you want to tell me why you think Bartoszewski's wrong, you can, but do remember, we're not the Supreme Court.
Well, and I fully appreciate that position, Judge. But I think if this court, if Bartoszewski is incorrect, as I argue, and it basically expands the common law, it did not consult the common law when it decided the issues before it, then I think that, and a lot of it I think is even dicta, then that's not controlling on this court, at least the dicta part of it. For example, on this issue of the awareness, whether the victim has to be aware of the taking, that was, to me, that's clearly dicta in Bartoszewski, and as I understand it, that's not binding on this court.
Well, I'll accept that, so let's take that one. Is it really the law that the victim needs to be aware? I mean, take a fairly common situation. Robber comes up behind somebody, unbeknownst to somebody, knocks them out, you know, with a bat, and then steals their stuff. The victim is obviously not aware. And how can we say that the victim has to be aware of a robbery?
But that is the situation where the use of force was to render the victim unaware. Okay, and I think there's a case that discusses that in my brief. So I think that's a little bit of a different distinction here, because here, that's not the scenario. The scenario is that the owner is in the cooler, completely out of sight, hearing of what's going on. And so how can he be aware?
So let's focus on that. I mean, and please push back if I get the facts wrong. But my understanding is he was in the cooler trying to restock this particular beer. He peeks out and he hears a noise and he sees some kind of tumult. He sees one of the perpetrators. He then kind of runs and hides in the bathroom and, you know, basically pretends to be calling 911. This is, I suppose, so we have a situation where he sees a threat, he's hiding, and he may not be aware of the robbery because he's afraid, he's been scared. So it's the threat of force that caused him not to be aware. He ran and hid.
Well, I think left out of that scenario, and I think the record bears this out, he didn't see any weapon. And no threat of force was directed at him to make him believe that he was under, even be aware that a robbery was going down. I think that's the clear import of his testimony, is he didn't know that a robbery had happened until after he came out of the bathroom, and the perpetrators had left, and he saw the customer on the floor. That's the point at which he realized something was amiss.
No, I'm sorry, he'd gone into the bathroom and called 911. So doesn't that refute your suggest that he didn't know anything was amiss until he saw the poor customer line up?
Anything in the sense of a robbery going down. And that any threat was directed at him. And I think that's another issue here.
I think the evidence was that he pretended to call 911, and he yelled out shot, 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 or something to that effect. So he must have thought something was happening.
I'm not sure about the shot, 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 but I do remember that he did. I do recall that he did call 911. But this goes to another issue, which I think the Attorney General takes issue with, is whether or not the threat has to be towards the victim who is the victim of the property theft. Because they do say in the statute, they cite to the statute where it says any person or any the victim, the owner of the property or any other person. But again, I think that is contrary to the common law.
But what about the Benton case? I mean, our division of this court in 91 said an aggravated robbery, the force can be applied to some other person and not necessarily the person robbed.
But I think that if I went back and took a quick look at those cases, and my impression of those cases is that they all feed on Bartoszewski. There may be some authority in cases in this court in support of the prosecution's position, but they all flow from Bartoszewski. That's why Bartoszewski is critical. And if Bartoszewski is incorrectly decided, then those court of appeals decisions that follow Bartoszewski are also suspect. I see I have about 3 minutes, 4 minutes. I'll reserve the rest of the time.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Hostetler. Ms. Moraleta.
May it please the court, my name is Carmen Moraleta and I represent the people. My attorney registration number is 34852. I'm going to go straight to the heart of your questions and move on. Essentially, defendant is asking this court not to follow Bartoszewski because it was wrongly decided, because it didn't properly follow common law, and because the holdings in Bartoszewski that support the people's positions, he argues, are dicta. He can argue that in the Supreme Court, he can argue that Bartoszewski's holding is wrong, but this court is bound by Bartoszewski, and that should be the end of the inquiry.
Let me jump in and take you right there. So on Bartoszewski, I think the most difficult part for your side, Ms. Moraleta, is this taking from the presence of. I mean, so I guess I'll ask you, what evidence was there that the liquor was within the owner's reach or observation so that he would have been able to retain the property but for force directed at him? I think that is the standard under Bartoszewski.
Yes, so Bartoszewski, the holding is, with from the present is not as much a matter of eyesight as it is proximity and control. And so the standard is, but for the force, threat, intimidation, the owner in this case would have been able to retain control or somehow prevent the taking. And let me quickly remind you of the facts in Bartoszewski. The victim was an 8-year-old girl, and the killing occurred in the dining room of the house, or the lower part of the house, and the taking occurred upstairs from different rooms. And the court in Bartoszewski concluded that that was sufficient to meet the within the presence of the victim. And there we're talking about a family home, a family residence. In this case, the liquor store was a very small store, very small. And the owner, the cooler was in the back of the store, but the door had been left open. And it was in the back, I don't know how far, but again, it was a very small liquor store. And as to the facts, because I know you talked about what actually happened, he went to the cooler to grab some beer for the customer. And as he was in the cooler, and as he was coming out, he heard something, like a shh. And then he saw someone holding something and pointing in his hand, and then he saw the customer lying on the ground. So he was scared, and he ran to the bathroom and pretended, specifically, this is what he said, I have this side in the quote, he yelled, 911, shot, 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 robbery, in an attempt to scare the robber. So he, while this was going on, he became aware that a robbery was occurred. And that's the reason why he ran to the bathroom to protect his life.
Well, let me ask you, this is a hypothetical. I'm just trying to figure out how, there's a little bit of a conflict, I guess, between the robbery and aggravated robbery statute, but whether the threat has to be directed at him. Let's take a scenario where the robbers don't, they don't even know he's there. Mm-hmm. So he peeks out and he sees a robber pointing a gun at a customer. And he's never even seen, the owner's not seen. Is that enough to establish a threat against the owner? They don't even know he's there, the robbers. You know, they're pointing a gun at a customer. Is that enough because there's a general threat?
Well, if we're talking about a business, like kind of the same facts we have here, well, your hypothetical, I am not sure, but this court is reviewing the sufficiency of the evidence. This was a robbery that was planned. This was a business that was open for business. They had cased the store previously. So the day of the robbery, that store was open. So from that evidence, only the fact that was open, from that evidence, the jury could reasonably infer that the defendant knew someone was running the store, an owner or the clerk. Also the fact that a customer or someone was waiting in the aisle. From that evidence, the jury could also reasonably infer that either the owner or the clerk or the person running the store was helping this person. So there you have your culpable mental self knowing element that I think is the link you're looking for.
Yeah, no, I understand that. The concern I have is more, what's the evidence of the threat against the owner? Assuming a threat against the owner's report, you have to threaten him, or you know, to cause him to prevent him from being able to reach the liquor.
Yes. Well, the record we have, we don't know. I mean, it's silent as to whether he threatened the owner. What we know is the robbery was accomplished by the use of force, threat, or intimidation. And our reading of both the simple and the aggravated robbery statute, I think the threat can be directed at the robbery person or any other person.
Why did the owner run into the bathroom if he didn't feel threatened? That's a rhetorical question.
Why the owner?
Why did he run into the bathroom if he didn't feel threatened?
Well, exactly. He ran to the bathroom because he felt threatened. Right.
It seems like there's a difference between being aware of something happening and seeing something happening. And actually, Mr. Hasseler switched his language a little bit there. He was probably aware of something happening just from those facts, but he didn't see it happening. I don't know if the law requires that he see it in order to perceive a threat or not. I think there's some cases where the person's in another room and the threat is considered to be directed at that person.
Yeah,
I
agree with you. I don't think the evidence is clearly sufficient to support that the owner became aware of their robbery. He said, shout, robbery. So, and that's the reason why he ran to the bathroom to hide and hopefully save his life. But again, we know both the aggravated and the simple robbery statute, the threats can be directed either at the person robbed or any other person. And although, I mean, reading them in a different way, I think it would be kind of going against the intent of the General Assembly to have or to protect person from dangerous felonies such as robbery and aggravated robbery in this case.
Let me, if I can, while you take a breath here, Ms. Morelletta, shift gears a little bit. I know that Mr. Hostetler didn't raise the expert issues. I'd like you to address, if you would, the firearm and tool mark expert issue.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would say I have a little bit of concern here. I mean, this NAS report, you know, really talks about how, you know, this is not, you know, I don't want to say not reliable, but it kind of questions how accurate the testing is. As you know, you can't really say, you know, this is a match for sure. Why don't we have a serious reliability question on that evidence based on that NAS report?
Well, first of all, this type of testimony has been held reliable since the early 2000s, right? And we apply this SREC test to this type of evidence. Here, the testimony was relevant because it placed the defendant at the crime scene, also helped explain the fact that two guns were used during the commission of the crimes. also the NSA report, and other defects such as any lack of proper documentation or peer review. Those are matters that go to the weight of the evidence, not its admissibility. This, the National Academy of Science report, is just one of the factors, I guess, that courts can take into account and into consideration when they are considered the reliability, but it's just one. It's not the one, it's not determinative. And I think that's how courts have been handling these reports, and not in Colorado, because I don't think we have any reported published opinion, but in other cases that have handled this this type of dealing with the NSA. Quickly. Yeah, as I said, the reports, again, go to the weight of the evidence, but not its admissibility, yes, and the other, as I said, things that might affect the reliability of the testimony.
Well, let me parse that a little bit. So I can understand pretty well why just you have to do this correct documentation, mm-hmm. whatever else, that makes some sense to me to say that would go to weight. But the report itself really questions how accurate this science is, and it is not as accurate as one's perceived. There are mm-hmm. real questions. It's very subjective. I suppose the question of whether it's a real subjective call seems to be less an issue of weight and more of one of reliability. I mean, the whole concern about Shrek is the aura of scientific infallibility, right? You don't want mm-hmm. to present that to a jury. Could you address that part of the NAS reports where it talks about this is really a subjective call? It's, you know, so it's not as clear science as was once thought.
Well, I haven't read the whole report. I just kind of look at it a little. And it just simply calls into question that. I don't think that it's like a conclusive determination. This is no longer scientifically reliable. This is no longer valid. And you have to use the report we are talking about in the court, judicial, criminal system, not in a scientific convention. We're talking about reasonable reliability. We are not talking about using scientific infallibility. So again, that's the reason why it goes to the weight, and that's why courts is now taking a look into that. Was this NSA report, what it means, how can we use this? Essentially, it's kind of telling the courts, let's not take this for granted. Let's just take a look, it's another factor, but let's not take this for granted only because we've been doing it for decades. But that's how I read it, and that's how courts in other jurisdictions have been using the NSA report.
NAS. NSA is different.
That's right.
Their report, we don't even want to hear about it.
National Academy of Science report. Thank you.
Yeah. Is it much different than fingerprints? I mean, I don't know that I really understand it, but when a fingerprint expert looks at the fingerprints and he says, this point, that's a subjective opinion of him. And now I know that they're starting to erode the reliability of fingerprints. Uh-huh. I think I've heard that coming up, but at this point, I'm not sure that the tool mark, status of that is such that it's been so eroded that, yes, it's subjective. And if it's subjective, you could put on your counter expert as they
exactly
did here. And he says, this doesn't fly.
Yeah.
But the jury has a right to believe one expert or another.
Exactly. To some extent, everything's a little subjective because we're human beings. So, so unless the court has any other questions. Well, the people request that defendant's convictions be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Morlita. Mr. Hostet, you have 3 minutes and 48 seconds.
I don't know how fast I can talk today. I'll just start very briefly with the comments about the expert witnesses. This is kind of a generic, overarching argument regarding both of the experts that were involved here. I think what the prosecution is asking this court to do is to make a determination that the subject of these experts is in fact reliable testimony that a jury can hear. They're asking this court to make that determination. This is the wrong court to do that. There's a particular statute in this passage in their brief where they say, we ask this court to find this is reliable evidence. Well, the issue here is what did the trial court do? And that's the real rub here. The real rub is that the trial court placed the burden of showing, establishing reliability of the evidence on the prosecution, on the defense. They went to a hearing. The defense said the prosecution, as the proponent of the evidence, has the burden of producing evidence to show reliability and the burden of persuasion to show this court that it's in fact reliable. That's wrong. That's what the defense argued. The defense and the prosecutor and the judge said, no, that's wrong. They forced the defense to put on the prosecution's witness in order to establish that it was unreliable and not reliable. So that's my issue there.
Well, I guess I need a little help because I'm not sure I understand. So on the firearm and tool mark expert, both sides put on very credible experts. The court heard it. The court did cite the four Schreck factors, as I recall, and the court said, I think that it's reliable and the issues that you have go to weight. So I guess I'm not, maybe I'm not following.
Well,
the burden is the Schreck test.
Right. If the court goes into a hearing with the mindset that it is the defense that has to persuade me that this is unreliable and inadmissible, then the court's mindset is applying the wrong standard of proof. They're not holding the prosecution's feet to the fire in terms of being the proponent of the evidence.
But in the end, the court did make a finding of reliability, and that's all it has to do under Schreck. I understand what you're saying. It started the... It's like, talk me out of granting summary judgment, which a lot of judges will do.
Yeah, it has to do that under Schreck. But it has to do that following the proper procedures of the burden of persuasion and burden of proof. If the mind, that ultimate conclusion that the judge makes about reliability is tainted by the fact that he, in his mind, it was the defense that had to persuade him that it was unreliable and inadmissible.
Did the court say that? I'm struggling here because I don't recall the court saying anything about the burden of proof and who carries it. Firearms, but go ahead, please.
At the very beginning of the hearing on the firearms issue, and I can't, in my brief, I don't have 25 seconds to find it, but it's discussed in the brief, and at the beginning of that hearing, the defense specifically said, we want the prosecution has the burden of proof and burden of going forward. The judge says, no. He says, you have the burden of going forward because he made the defense put on the first witness in the case. So that's where I think the same dialogue can be found in the situation of the cell phone expert. The judge basically is putting the burden of persuasion, the burden of proof on the wrong party. And that means his determination is not according to law. It's a matter of law.
Thank you, Mr. Hostler. We thank you. We thank you, Ms. Morleda, for your arguments. As always, they're helpful to the court. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. Counselor excused.